Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today's first guest, PBS NewsHour special correspondent Jane Ferguson, just won a Polk Award for foreign television reporting for her reports from Yemen. Next month marks the four-year anniversary of the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war on Yemen, a country of 18 million people. An estimated 60,000 people have been killed. Last June, Jane Ferguson smuggled herself in alone and disguised herself as a Yemeni woman. That was the only way to get past authorities. Jane Ferguson reports that there is no country on earth with as many starving people as Yemen. And this famine is entirely man-made. Two-thirds of the country need food aid to survive, and over 50,000 children have perished due to starvation or preventable diseases. Jane Ferguson has been reporting on Yemen for 11 years. She's a Beirut-based special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She's reported in-depth features from Iraq, Turkey, and Lebanon, and she's the recipient of this year's Polk Award for foreign television reporting. And Jane joins us from Lebanon. Hi, Jane. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Well, great to have you back, and congratulations on your much-deserved award for your reporting on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. On your Facebook page, Jane, you thank several people who made your reporting possible, and you say that they also deserve credit for the Polk Award. We rarely see or hear about the locals who are dealing with the impacts of war, and without local journalists, it would be very difficult for foreign correspondents to file for reports. So can you first tell us about the people who've helped you along the way and how they've been affected by the war in Yemen?
Sure, absolutely. You know, to your point there, which is absolutely correct, foreign correspondents, whether they work in print or television or radio, there's no way any of us could do our jobs without the help of the local staff that we work with. That goes for telling stories from Iraq to Afghanistan to Yemen to Syria, everywhere. And every journalist relies heavily on local expertise and people on the ground who very often have more at stake in covering these stories. We, of course, have the privilege of flying out to our comfortable and safe lives after just a couple of risky weeks on the ground. For them, it's 365 days of the year. So, you know, in Yemen, this was particularly the case for me. Because of the logistics of this story, I had to go, as you've said, you know, by myself and undercover. I wasn't able to bring my own team of people or a cameraman myself with me. So when I got to Sana'a in Yemen, I was hiring local people that I had worked with before over the years, and fixers and drivers and this time also cameramen. And so, you know, some of them wanted to be were comfortable with me identifying them and saying, you know, this is Mohammed, he's my cameraman, and you know, he's amazing and he works unbelievable hours. And then, you know, then others were not quite so comfortable. It's important to remember people there are stuck in between two warring sides and they don't know who's going to win. So I obviously respect their wishes. But sure, I mean, my team there in June, I was there for nearly a month, and they worked tirelessly. It was Ramadan, the holy month for Muslims, where they will fast from sunrise to sunset. And it's always tough. It changes with the moon cycle every year, and so it's always tough whenever it falls in the summer. Longer days, incredibly hot temperatures, to not be able to drink water. It's extremely difficult. As an aside, they also are not allowed to smoke. They choose not to smoke cigarettes, so that can make people a bit grouchy too. People really went the extra effort. The Yemenis that I worked with, from my cameraman Mohammed, my driver Fouad, my fixers, everybody worked incredibly hard to make this work. I would have not been able to shoot a single second of footage without them.
Mm. Are you still in touch with any of them?
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Almost all of the team I'm still in touch with. So not everybody is on social media, so it's not always as easy.
And how are they doing? I mean, what is life like in Yemen today?
It's extremely tough. you know, obviously the war and the violence is traumatic and dangerous and frightening for people, but it's the economic collapse that hurts people the most. You know, for instance, you know, one of my fixers and my driver, they used to work in tourism. They used to work with people who came on vacation to Yemen, because Yemen has so many historical sites, so much natural beauty. It's an incredible place to visit on vacation. And, you know, relatively intrepid tourists used to go all the time from Europe, Japan. And, you know, they used to have well-paying jobs or successful businesses running companies. So, you know, everybody's hurting. Financially, it's extremely difficult to make ends meet. So I think that's the biggest impact for everybody that I speak to. But also politically, it's difficult for people. They're stuck, like in any war, between two sides, just trying to survive, feed their families, and be professionals. So, you know, there's pressure and you know, like I said earlier, people on the ground in any war zone who come from there and stay after we leave, they risk much more.
Jane, I remember during your reporting for the PBS NewsHour, you did a great job of really giving some context to the story. And you had the time to actually explain why this is happening. And I find that we don't really get that in some of the print pieces, especially when we learned about the U.S. House voting to end support for the war. There wasn't that much context in those stories. So can you spend some time for people who don't really know, you know, why this is happening? Talk a little bit about what happened when the Houthi rebels from the north captured the capital, Sana'a, in 2014 before sweeping south.
Sure, no problem. Just to your comments there, I completely agree with you. If we just cover, as the media, if we just cover news events rather than that on a story that we haven't been covering, we can't expect the public to understand those events or be able to place them in any kind of context. But what happened in Yemen, it's actually been a very long and tragic decline since the Arab Spring, effectively. In 2011, there were Arab Spring protests, movement that removed the then dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh. And he agreed to step down after quite a lot of months of protests. He agreed to step down, but he didn't leave Yemen. And basically, after he left, there was a caretaker government. It was led by his former vice president. And he had won a referendum, effectively. So he did have the support of the people for a certain period of time. And in that period of time, there was a process put in place. And that fell apart. We saw everything go wrong, basically, in efforts to maintain peace and have a peaceful transition in Yemen in terms of power. Effectively, you had a dictatorship that had been in place for over 30 years that had a sort of very fragile, but certainly one that held the country roughly together, alliance of important tribes and basically power structure. And that, you know, once you've taken that away, then you start to see things start to crumble. And that's exactly what happened in 2012 and 13. You saw military mutinies with certain generals. You saw fighting breaking out in the capital between various fighting groups. What happened was this rebel group that now control northern Yemen, called the Houthis, they are as sort of a Zaydi, and that's a sort of loosely related to Shia Islam. They're a revivalist group, effectively. And they took advantage of the chaos. And with the help of Ali Abdullah Saleh's followers, he himself stayed in the country, had a lot of support from military units. They basically were able to sweep into the capital and take control. And that's what happened in 2014. Now, that was unacceptable to Yemen's Sunni Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, to the north, who they share a massive border with, because the Saudis became extremely worried that this group, they viewed this group as Shia, they viewed them as too close to Iran, and you know, basically they couldn't have, they would refuse to accept a capital that had been seized and was being controlled by a group that could become closer and closer to Iran at the time. So they got together with other Sunni Arab nations to form a coalition in 2015 and started launching a military campaign against the Houthis to try to push them back. Initially, they had some success because the Houthis had fought their way down south through the country and they were trying to take over the whole area. So the coalition managed to push them back within the first few months, but the campaign stalled very quickly and the front line effectively stopped moving. And basically you saw the airstrikes intensified, and the campaign had largely for several years now relied on an aerial bombardment.
You have reported closely on the humanitarian crisis, and what are the latest numbers? An estimated 60,000 people have been killed, and two-thirds of the country needs food aid to survive?
Yes, Yemen is a country of roughly 28, 29 million people. And the United Nations, their World Food Program is trying to feed 18 million at the minute. They've said that, you know, ideally they would like to be feeding 21 million, but the numbers are just so overwhelming. We're talking billions of dollars every year in aid to keep people alive. Of those 18 million, I mean, there are at least 8 million who are the most severely hungry. So what does that actually mean? That actually means that people can't afford to buy food, so they need the aid agencies to help them basically with their daily calorie intake. So we're talking two-thirds of a country effectively really need the help. And that's just, so the numbers are simply unsustainable financially as well.
And as you report, there is no country on earth with as many starving people as Yemen. Over 50,000 or more children have died due to starvation. And Jane, you have just a very sad short video of a little girl who is clearly so hungry. I mean, she's got a massive stomach. I mean, it's just hard to watch, but it's important to watch to realize and understand just how serious this is.
It is. That number, that 50,000 number, came out several months ago from the organization Save the Children. And when I went back to Yemen in December, I traveled around. That's when I filmed that little girl. Her name is Ikram. Mm. And we met her and her mother in the children's hospital ward in Sana'a, at a hospital in Sana'a. And Ikram is 4 years old and is, I mean, when her mother removed her shirt, we were absolutely in awe. We couldn't believe she was able to stand. And unfortunately, the difference between June and December was quite remarkable. Going to the hospitals, there were more starving babies and more skeletal children. And, you know, one thing that concerns me and scared me the most was that a lot of doctors and nurses would say, look, you know, we feel as though the high price of fuel means parents can't afford to take their kids here. Like these are children coming from rural villages, and their parents cannot afford the cost of renting a car, taking a taxi into the town, because their child is starving and needs help in a hospital. And that if fuel prices were to dip, that they would they feel like that they could increase threefold at least. So the frightening thing, the concerning thing in Yemen as well, is this idea that we don't really know how many children are starving off, you know, in the mountains, in remote areas, cut off from the urban centers where they can get help.
What did you hear from the parents, Jane?
Parents say that, you know, at first, what's interesting, you know, Yemenis are very proud, and they don't, you know, it's a very sensitive subject to report on. You have to be you have to really, really focus on listening rather than, mm-hmm. you know, being too aggressive whenever you talk to parents in hospital wards. Obviously, this is an indescribably horrible time in their lives. But for parents, initially they'll say, we don't know what happened, she's just sick. And I think that comes along with a certain degree of feeling like there's a stigma around not being able to feed your children. And eventually people open up and they tell us their story. And it's almost always exactly the same. It is the child's father lost work because the economy has collapsed, and they survived off of savings, then they survived off of family, extended family, then they survived off of a line of credit at the local store. They ate any livestock they might have had, and now it's all gone. And you know, you'll hear these stories across Yemen. That's why millions are starving, because the economy has collapsed. And so that is robbing, you know, when people can't make a living, it doesn't matter how much food is getting into the country. They'll not be able to buy it. So that's basically what parents are going through at the moment.
In addition, according to the UN, almost 18 million people lack access to safe water and sanitation. Almost 20 million lack access to adequate health care. So you've got poor sanitation, waterborne diseases, including cholera, and that's leaving thousands of people ill.
It is, and it's especially, this is where you get that vicious cycle. You have a malnourished child, they're so much more susceptible to infectious diseases and viruses. And so So the two feed into one another. It's very difficult to differentiate between whether or not a child starved to death or a child was starving and then died of a disease. But what we've seen in Yemen, famously, is the world's biggest outbreak of cholera. But also, and this frightens doctors much, much more, is the current outbreak of diphtheria. This is something that has a much lower survival rate for children, even if they do make it to hospitals. So hospitals are now having to set up these sort of relatively isolated diphtheria wards, and children are coming in, you know, gasping for breath. It's an extremely dangerous disease. Cholera is too, of course, and we've seen this both in December and January. Patients with cholera, more so in December, because it is a seasonal disease, depending on the weather. And you know, you see many little children. I saw one little boy in a hospital in Hadja, which is a rural area of the north, who had been sick twice in a month. He had to return to the hospital for treatment of cholera because, as you say, it's a sanitation problem. You know, trying to keep a home or a village sanitary whenever there's been an economic collapse and public services are gone, it's very difficult.
Jane, are you able to go back to Yemen to report from these areas?
I'm not sure yet. I'm trying. Hmm. It's becoming more and more difficult. It is not easy to get a visa, and the rules change regularly. And so we shall see. I will definitely be trying.
Today we're speaking with Jane Ferguson. She has been reporting on Yemen for 11 years, and she just won this year's Polk Award for foreign television reporting for her coverage of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. She's joining us from Lebanon, and you can find her reports at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments for Jane, it's yourcall@kalw.org. The number is 866-798-8255. We have just a general email for you, Jane, from Ruby, who says she watches every report you deliver. She admires and respects your dedication and your tenacity. And she's grateful for the sacrifices you and your team have made to bring us these important stories. I want to ask you about the significance of the United States House voting to end support for the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen. This just happened a couple weeks ago, and the Senate is expected to vote in the coming weeks. How significant is this?
I think it's significant in principle, in terms of we have, over the last several months, not unrelated to the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal al-Khashoggi, we have seen a turning tide in terms of public opinion and also public awareness of this war. And I think that that is what is reflected in the movements in Congress. And, you know, we're seeing congressmen and women. A lot of people write to me and say, you know, I didn't know about this. You know, viewers, they'll write in and they'll say, we weren't aware of this situation, but we're going to write to our representatives. And so I do think that the American public are becoming more aware. After I was in Yemen in June, we also saw that very famous New York Times article that was on the front page with the little girl that was profiled there. Her photograph became quite viral, and sadly, she also passed away to starvation. And we've also seen other news outlets like CBS and the BBC all going in there as well, and the Washington Post itself. So I do think that these moves in Congress do reflect a growing pressure. And I think that's coming from the ground up. I think it's coming from the fact that this war was largely uncovered for several years because journalists were kept out, and also because of the news cycle interested in other things, covering Washington, D.C., covering Trump. So, you know, I think that has started to change over the last 6 to 7 months. And this is a reflection of that. But the significance of it practically on the ground will remain to be seen effectively, because, you know, it really is not clear whether or not these moves will be enough, to whether they'll really translate into pressure on the coalition to engage more politically, to make sure that they stand by agreements on Hodeida, and for all sides to really try to sit down, to really take seriously the UN-backed efforts to bring peace to Yemen.
What about those peace talks? The UN has sponsored talks between the Houthis and the Saudi-backed government in the south. What do you think will come of these talks?
I think most people were pleasantly surprised when in December the talks did come to an agreement. The Stockholm Agreement, as it's being known now, came out in December, and it resulted in a very fragile and imperfect ceasefire in the important port city of Hodeida, where lots of food aid comes in, keeping most of the northern areas of the country alive. So that city is one that has been a major priority for Martin Griffiths, the UN special envoy to these talks, who has been trying to get to make sure that that city doesn't experience an offensive, a major military offensive by the coalition, because it's currently controlled by the Houthis. So trying to get both fighting forces to leave that city is effectively the next step. And that has proven very, very difficult. You know, the deadlines have come and passed since that agreement in December, where both sides were meant to redeploy, and pull back, and leave the city to a more neutral force. You know, the agreement was vague in its wording, as was probably necessary just to get it passed off. But so far we're seeing both sides accusing one another of violations, and neither side has yet redeployed their troops. But at any moment, we're expecting that it could happen. If that happened, that would be a major breakthrough. If it doesn't, the danger is a return to fighting in the city, but much, much more intensive fighting.
We have an email from Tim who says, I just want to express my appreciation for the courage and dedication of Ms. Ferguson. Without brave reporters willing to take remarkable risk, we remain uninformed. Maybe when confronted with the horror show that is Yemen, the U.S. might be forced to acknowledge our complicity and quit selling weapons that support this nightmare. Let's spend a couple minutes, Jane, on the issue of weapons. In the aftermath of Jamal Khashoggi's murder, Germany imposed a ban on weapons exports to Saudi Arabia, and the U.K. is urging German officials to lift the ban, but Germany says it will not budge. And then U.S. weapons companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin supply 57% of the military aircraft used by the Saudi Air Force, according to the Progressive magazine. And then you've got the United Arab Emirates signing weapons deals worth $5.5 billion at the opening day of the weapons show just happened in Abu Dhabi, including a $1.6 billion deal with Raytheon. And then there's China. They're selling armed drones. And according to CNBC, Saudi Arabia has already deployed China's armed drones in Yemen. So given the role of all of these international players and the obscenely profitable weapons industry, what are your thoughts on this, Jane? I mean, what are the prospects of this war ending anytime soon?
Well, you've really pointed out the numbers there are quite remarkable, given that this appears to be an obscure war that, you know, rarely makes the press. I mean, effectively, Yemen has become a great example of the profitability of war. And, you know, basically those that are arming the coalition, you know, they do say, look, we're fighting Houthi rebels who are backed by Iran. We do have evidence that Iran have been helping them with weapons and with and helping them being able to basically modify their own weapons. That's a threat to us. But the bigger debate over this is, and Yemen has really sparked this debate, and it could apply to other countries as well, is what responsibility do countries have when they sell weapons to a country in terms of how they use them? Those who are in favor of maintaining U.S. support to the Saudi-led coalition say, if we're not on the ground there showing them how to use these weapons, they'll use them incorrectly. It could cause more civilian casualties. But the bigger question is, what if they didn't? What if the weapons supplies were stopped? And like you say, the Germans have said no, but effectively the two biggest suppliers are Britain and the United States. And, you know, this is big business right now. We've seen Trump take a stand. Of course, before Trump, Obama signed off on many deals as well with the Saudis. Right. So we're not seeing a massive change in policy. We're seeing, though, a change in the rhetoric, a change in the attitudes towards what this means. Trump has said business is business. We don't, you know, really have any reason to cancel these contracts whatsoever. But Yemen is pointing out that, you know, not only are these weapons being used in a war in a way that does kill civilians, but also, you know, there's been some excellent reporting most recently by a colleague at CNN, by Nimal Baghir. They've pointed out as well that we don't know whose hands these weapons often end up in. This is another major challenge because, you know, the Saudis aren't on the ground fighting this war. That's important to remember. They have proxy Yemeni forces that they themselves aid. There are Emiratis on the ground, but the vast majority of fighters are Yemeni. Many of them are Sudanese, foreigners. Other reporting by the Associated Press has also raised the issue, and the Washington Post, that fighters that have been linked to Al-Qaeda are also fighting on the side of certain coalition partners. So where those weapons end up is also a major concern as well. And I think that for many years to come, Yemen will be studied and viewed as a war where the difficulties and the problems that come after making money from selling weapons are really, you know, coming to the surface.
Well, we will continue following this. Jane, thank you so much for joining us. And again, congratulations on your Polk Award.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Jane Ferguson has been reporting on Yemen for 11 years. She is a Beirut-based special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and she's the recipient of this year's Polk Award for Foreign Television Reporting for her coverage of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. We will definitely do a show looking at weapons profits and weapons companies in the near future. Coming up after a break, we will be joined by Jason Motlog. He wrote an in-depth piece for National Geographic called Inside El Salvador's Battle with Violence, Poverty, and U.S. Policy. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. It's better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, Joshua Johnson and 1A. Stay with us.
I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Reporting on the Central American immigration crisis often lacks information about U.S. foreign policy and the plight of the people who have been deported. Our second guest, Jason Mutlag, wrote an in-depth piece for National Geographic called Inside El Salvador's Battle with Violence, Poverty, and U.S. Policy. He reports that as migrants flee the Central American nation, changes in the United States could send thousands back into the chaos. Jason Mutlag is an award-winning writer, broadcast journalist, and filmmaker whose work focuses on conflict and human rights. He's reported from more than 50 countries for a number of publications, including National Geographic and Outside Magazine. Jason is the founder of Blackbeard Media, an Emmy Award-winning company that produces documentaries for Al Jazeera and National Geographic. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. Well, thank you for your really important piece. Can we first just talk about a couple basic facts? El Salvador is a population of just over 6 million people, and you report that El Salvador may be Central America's smallest country, but it's also the most densely populated and one of the deadliest. What other basic facts do we need to know about El Salvador?
Well, this is a small, densely populated country. It's a poor country, and it's a country that's still recovering from a 12-year civil war. And, you know, the driving factors of that conflict were never really resolved, but essentially it was a rural uprising against a military government backed by a landed elite that really wanted to protect their interests and would do anything to do so. And early on, the U.S. Got involved in the conflict, supporting the right-wing government with billions of dollars in aid, military support and training. And I think there's a consensus that that support ended up prolonging the conflict and ultimately enabled the military regime to perpetrate some really grievous human rights abuses that we found U.S. officials were complicit in trying to cover up over the years. So we have a very direct hand in that country's recent history, and a lot of the instability that has marked the post-war period and resulted, by and large, in this mass migration toward the U.S. border that you're seeing today.
Can we spend a little more time talking about this? Because the wall gets so much attention, MS-13 gets attention, but there's very little historical context in a lot of this reporting. And Elliot Abrams is getting some attention right now, the Trump administration's envoy for Venezuela, who was Assistant Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. He was heavily involved in policymaking regarding Latin America. Tell us about the effects that Elliot Abrams and his policies had on El Salvador.
Yeah, Elliot Abrams was a point man for the State Department in El Salvador at the time under the Reagan administration, when some of the worst crimes, massacres, rights abuses were committed. And we've seen from cables that have since been declassified that there were efforts inside the embassy to push back against that and support for the right-wing dictatorship and the death squads that they were backing, which were turned loose on the country with impunity. But in fact, at various intervals, the U.S. And the State Department was trying to cover up their activities, and Abrams was front and center in that effort. You know, one notable event, of course, was the El Mazote massacre, late 1981, in which troops armed and trained by the United States killed more than 1,000 villagers in eastern El Mazote department, most of them children. And in testimony, this is something that Abrams has downplayed as an incident that was just being used as communist propaganda, never squaring up with the reality of what happened, in spite of the overwhelming evidence that's surfaced over the years that elements inside the embassy and the State Department knew exactly what was going on and sought to cover up the aftermath and protect the perpetrators.
You report, Jason, that by the time the war ended, 75,000 people were dead, more than 1 million were displaced, hundreds of thousands fled to the United States. From L.A. to Washington, D.C., refugees found employment and community, and they sent money home. And you also write about the people who stayed and just how difficult it's been for them. You write about Jose Maria Guevara, a convenience store owner in El Mazote. He lost 30 relatives in that massacre, but he survived because he left and then he returned. He sent two of his children to New York. One cleans houses, the other works as a gardener. I mean, as we always say on the show, that everybody has a story. What really struck you about the people that you met who are in El Mazote?
Well, their relatives are among us. You know, I actually grew up in an apartment complex outside of Washington, D.C., and a lot of my neighbors were refugees from various conflicts in Central America and Southeast Asia, and, you know, I have memories that go all the way back, but, you know, I think anywhere we are in the United States, whether we're aware of it or not, we're interacting with these people. You know, they make up a huge portion of the service force inside the government in Washington, D.C., in construction. It's been estimated that, you know, if TPS holders were deported back to Salvador, forced to leave, that, you know, something like 20% of the workforce behind the D.C. construction boom would leave, which would have a really serious impact on the local economy. And, you know, just all across the country, whatever industry, these are people that are deeply embedded and rooted in the fabric of our communities. And a lot of them have been here for decades and have been law-abiding citizens and put children through school. And, of course, they're sending large remittances back to El Salvador, you know, which is a very poor country, and keeping some towns afloat because of these remittances. And so you know, suddenly ripping that away will have reverberations across the United States and all the way down to El Salvador.
And we'll talk about the TPS program in a couple of minutes. But first, Jason, can you talk about the importance of including historical context in reporting about the immigration crisis? I mean, what we heard about the caravan for so many weeks, it was front page news. You heard it on the radio. But very little context about the history. What do we lose? And how do you think public opinion is shaped when the history is not included in these reports? And we're not talking about a long time ago. I mean, we're talking about the 80s.
Yeah, we're not talking ancient history here. I mean, this is really recent history. It's a challenge we all face, you know. I mean, it feels more and more that news stories are getting reduced and oversimplified, and it's hard to include the context and the nuance that, you know, is essential to really understanding this migration phenomenon in its true light. You know, with the words that I had, I tried my best. I would have loved to have had more because there are many layers to it. But, you know, certainly the U.S. support for this right-wing government and the culture of impunity that engendered in the country, you know, we're still paying for that, the ghost of that, all these years later. There's a deep cynicism and distrust of institutions, and really just a nihilism that has overtaken the country. And, you know, you're seeing that borne out in just egregious gang violence, I mean, of an extreme nature that, you know, I've rarely seen anywhere in the world, including an active war zone covered. But, you know, more recently, you know, this war that the U.S. was supporting, that was driving all these migrants to the U.S., then groups started to form in places like Los Angeles, you know, as a matter of solidarity and identity in a foreign country. These gangs were hardened in U.S. prisons, and then in the 90s, under President Clinton initially, we started porting hardened convicts en masse back to Salvador. This is a country with broken institutions, ill-equipped to handle the pressure of all these criminals coming back. And since then, they've really run amok and just exacerbated the violence that, you know, we see engulfing the country today.
I think you did a great job with this, again, giving us some history about MS-13, because that's another issue that gets a lot of attention in sound bites. But as you report, so you've got the people who left El Salvador in the 80s, early 90s, and found employment and community in the United States. And as you report, the children who came with them were displaced youths, in many cases craving some kind of identity in a foreign place. And they created MS-13 on the streets of Los Angeles. And then another rival gang, 18th Street, a Hispanic gang that formed in Los Angeles. And then in the late 90s, as you just said, the U.S. exported them back to Central America. And then gang members were reproduced their social structures, and they multiplied exponentially. Again, that's just some context that we need when we hear about MS-13 in reports and from this administration?
Yeah, it's important. I mean, I met one longtime gang member, and his story sort of tracks the arc of all these conflicts and the evolution of the gangs. You know, he was a kid and experienced some of the street violence, saw people shot in front of him as a young teenager, fled to the United States with his family, ultimately made his way to L.A., was adrift on the streets there, gravitated towards a gang because it gave him something of a foothold. And this is when crack cocaine, of course, is hitting the streets in the 80s. So everything is metastasizing. It's getting much more violent. And, you know, we're going from street fights to gun battles. And very quickly ended up in prison. And then, of course, he's being sent back to El Salvador. And so, you know, that pedigree of trauma started way back when. And we're disingenuous to say that, you know, U.S. policy before the deportations did not have a very significant hand in shaping that mindset early on, and, you know, feeding the instability that tore the country apart for 12 years.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Jason Mutlog. He wrote an in-depth piece for National Geographic called Inside El Salvador's Battle with Violence, Poverty, and U.S. Policy. He reports that as migrants flee the Central American nation, changes in the United States could send thousands back into the chaos. If you have any questions or comments about Jason's reporting or reporting on the immigration crisis, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You also report on violence against women, Jason. In 2017, in El Salvador, 468 women were killed. That is one every 19 hours. Countless others are missing. And one survey found that only 6 out of every 100 women would even report a rape, reflecting an overwhelming fear of the gangs and a systemic betrayal by authorities.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, women are really being victimized. And we're seeing, you know, that their plight become worse and worse. You know, they're stuck in these neighborhoods that are dominated by the gangs. The gangs are the law. And it doesn't matter if you go to great pains to avoid the gangs and, you know, and keep your own space. You know, if you have relatives, which of course people do, then you become a pawn in that game and a target. So you're seeing a lot of revenge killings, women, daughters, sisters being targeted by rival gangs. And there's just so much cynicism about what the state can actually do to protect them that, you know, we talk about the number of murders and rapes and so on, but that's got to be a fraction of the actual figure. So much goes unreported because merely the act of the gang's control in some parts of this country is so dominant that just the act of reporting something like this would put you at risk, even if you're in the right, you know. And that's just the reality that women across the country deal with every day. And it's not getting better. It's only getting worse.
What are the challenges facing local journalists in El Salvador?
Well, you know, they have to sleep there. And so, you know, we get to come in. And, of course, the work that we do is largely facilitated by local journalists. Mm-hmm. And they're really essential to the whole reporting process. You know, I'm just another foreigner otherwise. But they have to very carefully navigate, you know, these fault lines that divide the country, and it can be very treacherous. You know, there's the example of Christian Poveda, a very brave documentary filmmaker who embedded in an 18th Street community for more than a year, 2 years, and, you know, deep ties and built up a lot of rapport with the gang members, and his film came out, and, you know, some apparently didn't like some of what it revealed, and he was killed. And that's just the reality of working there right now. And so it's a very difficult climate. I know a lot of journalists who have fled the country who are in the United States trying to get political asylum right now and struggling to do so. And, you know, to continue to work there is really an act of bravery.
Today, there are 200,000 Salvadorans living in the U.S. under temporary protected status. It offers legal status to certain immigrants in the U.S. who can't return to their country due to a number of reasons, natural disasters, armed conflict. And the majority of the people granted TPS are from El Salvador. Many have been living here for more than 20 years, but they're now in danger of being deported. In early 2018, the administration declared that Salvadorans would lose TPS and should leave the United States by September of this year, and a court blocked the order temporarily, but still there's really no final decision, and it's uncertain when one will be made. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not clear. It's tied up in the courts right now. At some point, it's likely to go to the Supreme Court, and you know, given the balance right now, it could end up getting approved. TPS could be scrapped, but you know, a federal judge blocked it in October, so it's given at least a momentary reprieve to more than 200,000 Salvadorians who have TPS status here in the United States, along with Nicaraguans and Sudanese and others. So we're kind of in a holding pattern right now. But, you know, just the prospect has really unsettled a lot of lives. You know, I spoke to many Salvadorans with TPS who work in the D.C. area. Some of them are working government jobs. Some of them working at embassies. You know, they're very invested in their lives in the United States. They've made good lives, and they have lots of family members back home that support them. And so, you know, to have that thrown in jeopardy really has knock-on effects for entire families. And you know what that then means if these breadwinners are being deported or then at risk and have to go to ground, you know, that has destabilizing effects back in El Salvador, when you have entire communities that depend on your remittances. You're more and more likely to flee in spite of all the hurdles that they face, just for a chance to get back in the United States.
You profiled a number of people. One, Jesus Silva, came to the U.S. more than 20 years ago to escape poverty and a lack of job opportunities in El Salvador. He's a single father of four U.S.-born children and supports them by working in construction. And he is a holder of a TPS. And,
yeah.
You know, what else really struck you about just the uncertain future, especially for someone who's been in the U.S. for more than 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we look at them as immigrants in Salvador, and they feel almost like Americans. You know, this is a country that they've come up in and gotten used to, and, you know, feel a sense of belonging. There's a huge, huge community. And so, you know, talking about going back to a country that they haven't known for, you know, maybe more than 20 years, you know, which is last at war. And, you know, they're, of course, tracking developments in El Salvador and proliferation of the gangs and the impunity and all of it. And there's just a lot of fear among these people about, you know, what having to leave might mean and for them and their families. And so, you know, I'm glad that for now things are on hold, and hopefully this doesn't come to pass. But it's just a very uncertain time for all these people.
And what happens to people who are deported, Jason? I mean, what awaits them when they get back, especially young men who are trapped in areas that are held by gangs?
Yeah, this is something I highlighted up at the top of my story. So often they're flown back on either unmarked or commercial airlines back to, from these detention centers around the U.S. back to an airport outside of San Salvador, and then they all get processed through this facility that was actually built in part with U.S. funding. And from there, they receive criminal background checks. You know, they're issued their belongings, whatever was left over from their time in detention. And if they're lucky, they get some bus fare, and then they're sent on their way home. And that's it. I mean, you know, maybe in some rare case, they might get some extraordinary protection. But right now, the state is taxed, and that's really it. And so, you know, as soon as they set foot outside that facility, they're at risk. And, you know, ironically enough, the facility is actually built in a gang neighborhood, and the rival territory is just a couple of blocks away. So you're really, you know, talking about a gauntlet of danger just to get home. And, so, you know, when I saw these deportees getting off the bus, I mean, it's just a sense of both dejection and fear about, you know, what next. How are we going to, you know, go day to day? And, you know, there are stories of migrants being killed not long after being returned. The risks are very real, and they don't really have any recourse once they're back in El Salvador.
Hmm. What is the difference between, or what is the difference in terms of what people who have been deported face between when it happened under the Obama administration and under the Trump administration? The New Yorker had a very surreal article last year about how U.S. companies are setting up call centers in El Salvador, and they're literally greeting people as they walk off the plane to say, do you want to work in my call center? And under the Obama administration, in 2009, the U.S. deported 2.7 million people, more than any previous administration. 152,000 of them were Salvadoran. So what has really changed for Salvadorans since the Obama administration deported people?
That's an important point to make, because there's this perception that suddenly, you know, under the Trump administration, the U.S. has become very anti-immigrant. And, you know, deportations were higher under, in terms of volume, under Obama, as far as I know. Mm. And so, yeah, that's continued to pace. I think what you're seeing is just a more aggressive outward posture, you know, and other anti-immigrant initiatives, like effort to, you know, the administration's effort to defund sanctuary cities or end DACA protections for unaccompanied minors, and so on. But, you know, it's really just a continuum from my immigration policies that have been in place for a long time. And as you mentioned, call centers in and around San Salvador are a cottage industry. They're growing. You've got a lot of entrepreneurs now who are introducing themselves to these deportees as soon as they get into the country. If not, word of mouth travels fast, and they find this is one of the only viable, decent-paying jobs that's available to them, making use of, you know, their familiarity with English vernacular and their time in the United States. So we actually visited a couple of these call centers, and you know, they're very modern facilities. A lot of the people there are relieved to have the work. You know, they're sitting in a glass office 10 stories above the street on the phone most of the day. You know, I can't say which companies, but, you know, it's entirely possible that some of the listeners here have spoken with some of these people over the phone if they're calling customer service. And, you know, that's a livelihood. But a lot of them, you know, also told me that, you know, that they don't want to settle. They don't see a long-term future in El Salvador. And as soon as they have the means, they, you know, want to muster the resources and find a way back to the United States. I mean, that has become their home. That is their identity, and they feel fairly alien from El Salvador.
Mm. And just quickly, Jason, were you able to find out how much these call centers are paying people? Is it a living wage?
It's a living wage. I don't remember offhand exactly, but I mean, it was certainly better than most of the other typical jobs on offer, and you know, a degree of stability and mobility within the job to climb. It's a growth industry, and you know, new operations are springing up all over the place. But that said, I do remember that it's still not, you know, nearly on par with, say, U.S. Minimum wage. It's significantly lower. You know, it's just enough to get by.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for your incredible piece, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. All the best.
Jason Mutlog is an award-winning writer, broadcast journalist, and filmmaker. He wrote an in-depth piece for National Geographic called Inside El Salvador's Battle with Violence, Poverty, and U.S. Policy. And you can find his story at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. You can find out more about the show and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.